Hello and welcome to Black All Year, the podcast where we explore what it means to centre blackness in all conversations, every day, every season, all year round. In this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Karen Orendel for a compassionate and insightful conversation about palliative and end-of-life care. Karen is a specialist rehabilitative palliative care physician and co-lead of the Hospice UK Race Equity ECHO, a collaborative network supporting racialized staff in palliative care. Currently pursuing an MA in public history at UCL, she brings a rich interdisciplinary perspective to her clinical work. Karen champions both staff and patient voices from Black and minoritized backgrounds, aiming to address disparities in access and outcomes at the end of life. Hi, Karen. I'm really pleased that you can join me today. And I'm really looking forward to talking about this because obviously it's something that takes up a lot of our lives, palliative and end of life care. It's our kind of our working days and nights, probably for you as well. But do you want to just introduce yourself a little bit first?
Thank you for inviting me first, Steph. My name's Karen Orendel. I'm a doctor who works for Marie Curie. I've been working in palliative care for 26 years now. 25 of those was in our hospice at Hampstead, where I mostly worked in our day therapy outpatient unit as part of a multidisciplinary team, taking a rehabilitative approach to patients and their families. So very personalised care and a wide range of input, such as medical, nursing, gym, lots of different psychosocial interventions.
Right. And you mentioned a term there, rehabilitative.
Yes.
Which, apart from the fact that I can barely say it because I've tried quite a few times, can you explain exactly what you mean by that rehabilitative approach?
Yeah. So a lot of people hear the word rehabilitation and palliative care and assume that, well, we can talk about later what palliative and end-of-life care is, but a lot of people think, how can you rehabilitate somebody who's near the end of their life or has a terminal illness? But this is an approach. It's about looking at goals, looking at about what's important to a person and trying to work with that. So some people have got medical problems. Sometimes it's the financial. It's about the burden they may feel on their families and caring. And it's really looking at goals that the patient would like to achieve and working in a very holistic way to help them achieve that as far as possible.
Great. Yeah. So it is that, because you're exactly right, because you think rehabilitation is about getting back to where you were, and that's not the context that this is in. And as you said, palliative and end-of-life care, you and I understand that. I was going to say most people in health do, but actually that's not true at all, is it? I think quite a lot of people in health don't understand, particularly palliative care. They don't really understand what that's about. So how would you describe palliative and end-of-life care?
Yeah, and I think some of the problem is that we now use that acronym a lot, PEOLC, palliative and end-of-life care. So they seem, they conflated with each other, but actually they are slightly different. And so I'll start with end-of-life care, which is usually defined here in the UK as somebody who's got a life-limiting illness. In other words, an illness from which they're likely to die and which they'll die within the next year.
Right.
Whereas palliative care is a far wider term that's the care and support that we give both patients and their families or significant others, and to receive the care from the healthcare professionals who are trained to give holistic care. And that means identifying, assessing and treating symptoms. And these can be physical symptoms such as pain or breathlessness, psychological or social symptoms, spiritual concerns. And so what we aim with palliative care is to prevent or alleviate suffering. And suffering can be defined by the patient. It doesn't necessarily mean a physical suffering. It can be existential suffering or other. And so, you know, within a team, palliative care, doctors and nurses often focus on treating physical symptoms with medications and sometimes non-drug treatments, but we can't work without the whole multidisciplinary team. So as I mentioned before, the holistic care, looking at their caring responsibilities, their finances, their home situation, or if they have a home. And so our specialised staff would include counsellors, social workers, physiotherapists, occupational therapists looking at physical and practical needs, the chaplain, art therapist, and if we're lucky, complementary therapists. And palliative care can be offered at any point after a patient has been given a life-limiting or terminal diagnosis, and is really focused on quality of life, providing support rather than cure.
Yeah, and I think that was one of the things that when I first kind of came into the world of palliative and end-of-life care through the hospice was about how long some patients have contact with our services. So it can be years sometimes that people will start off and maybe with a lighter touch contact, and it's a little bit of symptom control and things like that, through to possibly eventually end-of-life care. But that palliative part of their care is really, really important, but could be for quite a long time.
Absolutely. And up in our day unit, there are patients who I still know. I've got one lady who I've known almost since I started there, wow, who has got motor neuron disease, and she was walking when she came. Now she uses eye gaze technology and does a lot of painting with her eyes. And a lot of the work we did was the support, the general support, using the gym to maintain her function as far as possible, helping her with her family situation. And she reframed her life. And that's another phrase I use quite a bit, reframing your life. It doesn't mean that you don't have a life anymore after you've had an illness. There are just different ways of looking at your life. And that's what we try and help people with. So, yeah, people can have palliative care for many years, as you say. We look after patients who may have gone into remission. If they happen to have a cancer, their treatment may have made them steady, or they may even have, their cancer may have actually gone.
It's interesting you mentioned cancer there as well, because I think a lot of people immediately think, particularly with hospices, they immediately think cancer, don't they? But the fact that things like motor neuron disease and actually anything that is a progressive and life-limiting condition falls under that kind of the remit of palliative care and then end-of-life care.
That's absolutely right. I mean, we have patients who've got chronic heart disease, chronic lung disease, chronic kidney disease, they may be on dialysis, and they may have dementia, and that's often something people don't recognise. But obviously we realise that dementia is a bigger problem nowadays in society, and that it can be a terminal illness, can be quite over a long period of time. So exactly, lots of different conditions.
And the dementia one was the one, I think, for me, that I didn't realise people can die from dementia. I thought it was always they had dementia and then something else took their lives. But no, the fact that actually dementia can cause death, it can be a terminal illness, was not something that I was really aware of until probably the last 3 years. So people might go, okay, this is all very interesting, but why are you talking about it on Black Hole Year? But there is a huge inequality within palliative and end-of-life care. And what I think what's interesting about this is that it's not just a patient inequality. The workforce within palliative and end-of-life care is very stark as well in terms of its ethnic profile. Which would you like to look at first? Do you want to look at staff or do you want to look at patients first?
Patients.
Okay, let's start with patients.
Yes, let's start with patients. Well, I think this is a really important point, isn't it? As you say, there is so much health inequity across all aspects for people from minoritized ethnic backgrounds. It's well documented. There are now, there's the Race and Health Observatory, which is looking at very specific areas of inequality, but we haven't yet really tackled inequality of access to palliative care services. And there are probably quite a lot of barriers why people don't. And although there's been research over the last 15 or so years about what those barriers might be. We still haven't yet started tackling them enough. And I think there have got to be different types of ways the conversations are still being had. How do we do that? And so I suppose this is part of it today. It's making people aware. I think awareness is a big issue. Sometimes there's a gatekeeping by other staff, maybe the oncologists, the cancer doctors or other specialists who have got assumptions that, oh, maybe these people, in the sort of other extent, they look after themselves and each other and we won't need to refer them on, rather than asking the question. And so often people are only referred at the very end of their life.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, if they end up going into a hospice or being looked after at home and requiring drugs such as morphine, if they then die, that perpetuates a myth that morphine, you're going to be given morphine and that is going to kill you.
Yeah.
And that is an incredibly strong myth that even exists within my family.
Mm.
Because my mother, although she was a nurse in the NHS from the 60s to the 80s, those myths followed her through. And when my grandmother died 10 years ago, she's still convinced that happened to that my grandmother was killed in hospital and that was not true.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, these are real things and real fears that people have. Also for patients who don't speak good English, there are a lot of language barriers, poor communication about, you know, what is palliative care, why it might be helpful for them. And in certain cultures or languages, the concept of palliative care may not even exist, because the concept of palliative care that we use is a very British construct, really. And so it may not really fit within a concept that they understand. Other reasons are including the fact that people are scared to go into the health system anyway, a lack of trust of going into hospitals from the care or the racism that they've experienced, the people who've not listened to them. It's taken a long time to get a diagnosis because their symptoms have been flicked away. And so the idea of accessing the services may be scary for them.
Yeah, and I think I mean, there's so much there in what you've said that I kind of recognise. So first of all, that thing of at the amount of times that people have said to me, interestingly, all white people have said to me, is, oh, well, they take care of their own. I've spoken with people of other ethnicities and they've said, oh, we like to care for our family. And I've said, but this isn't going to stop you from caring for your family. And they've gone, no, you're right. And actually the way that I described somebody was, I said, would you want your loved one to go into hospital if they needed hospital care? Yes. Well, then why would you not want them to have palliative care? And they went, oh yeah, that made sense. So it was exactly about the way in which it's described. This is not you, particularly from a hospice perspective, it's not, well, you give your loved one to a hospice and it's like they're taken away from you. This is about the system supporting you and your loved one to be cared for in the way that they want, really, isn't it? That's what we're there for. It's that when you talked about that holistic care, it's about understanding what's important to you. And if actually having the ability to take care of your loved one is important to you and your loved one wants to be taken care of by you, then that's what we help to support. So that there's that. I think that that thing that you said there about the fear of the healthcare system is very real. Certainly, I know I've had discussions before about things like engagement in research for people from ethnically minoritized backgrounds, and that there's that suspicion and that worry, and that's based on things that have been done to us in the past. Where actually some really horrendous treatment has happened. But that fear of trusting the system to take care of you, at a time when you're actually very vulnerable and very scared, it is understandable. Interesting what you said about that model of palliative care and it being a very kind of European white model of care. Are you able to kind of expand a little bit on that? Because I'm curious about that.
Well, it's the whole idea of palliative care as it's described now. It was based on a concept by Cicely Saunders, who most people think of as the first person to devise this whole model in the 60s, which was very pioneering because at that time, people were dying in hospitals in terrible ways and nobody was looking at them in a holistic way. And so she created the model of, you know, looking at people from a physical, psychological, spiritual, financial, several different domains mm-hmm. to look at care. Those are all very important and they are all the basis and the foundation of what we do. But cultural care isn't part of that main model. And I think that looking at people from a with cultural sensitivity, understanding that there are different cultures and ways of doing things doesn't really come into this, and it's very easy for people to forget or not know. And from a staff point of view, if there's a lack of diversity amongst staff, then people are not going to understand that there are different ways, or as I mentioned earlier, different ways that people look after people, their families within their own communities, done in very different ways. Mm. And I think it often feels that palliative care services say, this is what we do. We're going to reach out and tell, you know, say to you, this is what we do. Come and get it. Or, you know, and they talk about the phrase hard to reach. Oh, those people over there are hard to reach. They're not having our services, which is what's known as a deficit model, where you're putting the onus on somebody else. And now we try and describe hard to access services. The deficit is on us. What is it that people want that we're not providing them with? It doesn't mean that because we do things I've described them at the beginning of this talk, that that's the way things should be done.
Yeah.
And that's where we need to start thinking, how do we enable our services to be available? Or even, are we providing the right services yeah. just because we've got a list of things? That may not be what someone wants from us. They may want someone to help look after their parent or wife or brother while they go out to work. And, you know, there are different elements to it that we haven't yet put our fingers on.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, one of the things that it's interesting because I prefer the term seldom heard, but even more prefer seldom listened to, because we hear people, yes. we don't actually listen to them. And I do like that hard to access services. But I think that idea, what we're trying to do at St. Oswald's is really start to say what's important to you and then how do we support you with what's important to you? So if somebody comes and they say they have a particular faith, so I'll take Christian, they say I'm a Christian, that could mean a million and one different things. Same with Muslim or Buddhist or whatever. So it's that, okay, so what does that mean to you and how does that affect the way that you want to be cared for? And having that kind of conversation rather than just going, okay, so here's our menu for people who are Christian or Muslim or Buddhist. It's that, what does that need? And particularly as we're going out into communities, taking time to understand, well, it's not just about what are the barriers to you accessing our service in terms of what are the blocks, but actually exactly that, are we providing the right services for you? And if not, how can we do that together? How can we make sure that we're giving you the support that your community, the support that they want, rather than us just coming and saying, well, this is how we do this. This is how we do bereavement. So really kind of having that shift. And to me, that's just part of the holistic approach. But I take that point of actually, it is a very Western European holistic approach that we've had before, which is, well, we think about the whole person, but only if you fit in this mold. And that probably goes beyond ethnicity as well, though I can imagine that there would be palliative and end of life care, you're more likely to get it if you are middle class than if you are working class. And that, again, probably is to do with some of those cultural needs and barriers and things as well. So, but particularly acute if you're ethnically minoritized. And Karen, you mentioned that we are more likely to get it wrong because our workforce is less diverse.
Yes, yes.
It really is, isn't it?
It really, really is. The most significant fact about that is nobody has yet done enough work within palliative care to prove what the statistics are. We know because we look around us, and we know because when we look at a screen on Zoom with 20 people, you may be the only face of a person of colour on that screen. And so it becomes very clear these days that that really is the case. A few years ago, about 3 years ago maybe, we started trying to look through Association of Palliative Medicine data, demographics that they were collecting. And they didn't collect very much on ethnicity, but what they did, they didn't focus on it and explain it. But when you looked, 75% of the specialties female, which is fantastic, but very few are from a minoritized ethnic background. And there was one person at the time that that survey was done, maybe 5-6 years ago, there was only one black consultant on that list. Wow. So there are a few more now, but it's so, so small. And I think we're one of the least diverse specialties that there are. And there are 50 medical specialties.
And this is the thing, I think for me, health is far more ethnically diverse than the general population in the UK. So if, when we look at something like the NHS, you will find that there are far more ethnically minoritized doctors, nurses, to an extent, but probably less so, occupational therapists and physiotherapists and things like that, than there are in the general population. So it's even more stark, really, that it's completely the other way and very underrepresented when you start to look at the specialty of palliative and end-of-life care. And, you know, you're very involved in talking to people about this. And are there any thoughts or theories as to what that's about?
Yes, most at the moment it's mostly hypotheses. Although I mentioned the Association of Palliative Medicine earlier on and what they hadn't done before, what we have done in the last 3 years is formed a race equity committee and done quite a big survey of as many people within palliative care, whatever role, to see whether they'd witnessed or experienced racism. And from that information we got there, well, there was a lot of racism in palliative care, whether that is from patients, families, or even staff. And that's not only the staff you work with on the ward, that's within HR. Some of the hypotheses are that because there are very few staff from minoritized ethnic backgrounds in middle and upper grades, people don't see themselves necessarily represented and don't think of going into it as a specialty. You really find that where I've worked anyway, where you mostly find people of colour in the service roles. So in housekeeping, in canteen, in the reception, in the facilities, and virtually none elsewhere. And then, of course, quite a few of the nurses who go into the communities, but otherwise not. And again, we're hypothesising, but whether there are cultural reasons, whether people, you know, agree the whole idea of palliative care, or whether there's kudos or not, it depends why you went into medicine. Did you want to be a surgeon or a GP? I mean, it's so difficult to know. We also, I mean, recognised from doing that work that there are a lot of international medical graduates and international nursing graduates. So these are people who have trained fully in the country of origin usually, and they've come to work here. And usually that means that they're pulled into areas and specialties where there's a high need, and that will be GP, surgery, various types of medical specialties, and often in rural places, and not being brought into palliative care. So I think that, you know, last year or the year before, I think there were a lot of, most of the GMC, new registrants to the GMC were from overseas. So we're getting a lot of people from overseas and not necessarily homegrown.
And I wonder as well whether, so this was one of the things when I used to work in the ambulance service, was that overseas, they quite often don't have an ambulance service. So then when you're trying to talk to people about that, there's no concept of what an ambulance is. So we were talking to communities that contained a lot of recent immigrants to the country, and they didn't understand what an ambulance was or did. You know, for example, in Ghana, ambulances tended to take people, take the coffin to the funeral. That's what ambulances were used for. They weren't used as an emergency service. So I wonder, is that something similar, that palliative care is not like general surgery, which is common across the world? Is it something that's specific to certain healthcare systems?
Yes, I think so. So if you look across the world, there isn't palliative care as a specialty in every country. Mm. Interestingly, I looked around for a couple of hospices in South Africa and in Nigeria because I was looking for some other information, and the websites looked almost like they'd looked here with white patients, which I found like fascinating. There wasn't a demographic that suggested the demographic in the country, but there are not palliative care services in every country in the world. And a lot of people may come here to be trained in palliative care and then return home.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I think there's this thing of I believe, and having worked in across a range of different healthcare areas, I think that there is something very unique and special about professionals who decide that they want to specialise in palliative and end-of-life care. It's not necessarily the place where people would immediately think, oh, I want to go there. It's not like orthopaedic surgery where you do somebody's knee and they can walk again. Isn't that wonderful? It's not that. I think it's beautiful, and it's actually quite uplifting, and I think it's a real honour to work in this field. But it's not the sexy end of medicine. Let's put it that way. It's not heart surgery. So I think already there's that limited pool of people that we're looking for to go into palliative and end-of-life care. So then I think if we're then finding that clinicians in particular are facing barriers like racism, then that's just going to be even more off-putting, isn't it? And it just shrinks that pool even more. And you've touched on one of the big challenges behind that, which is that then patients aren't necessarily getting the type of care that they could or should, really, because we're not getting that cultural understanding of what's going on.
Yeah, they aren't really getting enough cultural understanding, exactly as you said. I mean, there are even things that sound very trivial to other people that may not be trivial, and I think you'll understand as well as I do, like hair. That sounds like such a trivial subject to people. What does it matter about going into hospital or anywhere with your hair? But actually, afro-textured hair is very difficult to look after. And we have seen people who've not wanted to go into a hospital, a hospice or anywhere, because no one can look after their hair. And if it gets knotty, they might have to chop it off, or they won't look right. It makes a really big difference to people, something like hair.
What's really funny is when you said there's things that the first thing that came to my mind was hair. Because it is. It's that thing of, when you're ill anyway, the way that your hair is cared for and the condition that it's kept in can make all the difference. So, yeah, it's one of those, it's a small thing, but I think that's what you find quite often when people are palliative. It is the small things quite often that make all of the difference to them.
Yes, it really does. Mm-hmm. I think it does. In fact, in terms of the hair, that during COVID, there was an ITU nurse, I think she was in St George's Hospital, who actually started caring for the patient's hair and teaching others how you look after the hair and why certain products are or not work. Yes, and I think she even got an award for the fact that she had made that change and that difference to people who went into intensive care.
Yeah, and quite remarkable, actually, that because she'd been working there for 20-odd years as well, and you kind of think, how did it take so long, first of all, for her voice to be heard and for her to be able to say that, but for people to not realise that this was an issue, that people weren't getting the kind of personal care that they should get. So I think that it'd be interesting, what's happening? What are we doing to try and change some of this, particularly from a staffing perspective? Are there things going on to try and change that ethnic demography of the specialty?
In terms of training, I don't know myself. I haven't got much knowledge about how that is being dealt with as part of training, because I think that's really important. That's the place where you have to get it. In fact, you have to start at medical school. And until very recently, palliative care wasn't even taught in medical school. I wasn't taught about palliative care at medical school. And when I mentioned the word, when I was a junior doctor, a very junior doctor, the consultant in cardiology was like furious and walked off the ward. You know, and I suggested that a patient might need palliative care. And I didn't really know what it was myself at that point. And so I think really people need to understand, as you said right at the beginning, not all doctors or healthcare staff know what palliative care is in its entirety. So until we do that, we can't change things. There was a study by Claude Chidiac, who was in a big London hospital during the pandemic. And there were a lot of patients in an area of London which was very multicultural. And they noticed that despite the disproportionate number of minoritized ethnic communities in hospital, they weren't being referred for palliative care. And so what they did was actively went to the wards, actively spoke to doctors, actively looked for patients who appeared to have that need. And after the second wave, they found that things really changed about how and when that people were being referred to them. So hopefully during that episode, people learn more about what palliative care is and why they should refer. And also, hey, that sounds like a specialty that might interest me. I think in terms of staff, well, there's one way that I've been trying to do something, and that's three of my colleagues and I have set up what's called an ECHO. It's a community of practice. In other words, a group of people. There are lots of types of communities of practice where usually you have a particular training need that people then bring both their learning and their education to a group of other professionals to try and improve a situation, whether it's breathlessness, whether you're interested in how to tackle homelessness and palliative care. But we've set up quite a novel one, which is a meeting that's literally for people of colour who are in palliative care in whichever role they are in palliative care. It doesn't matter. And in which area you work, whether it's a hospice, at home, in the community, in the hospital. And the aim of meeting together for once a month is to provide a safer or a braver space for people to describe and explain or express their feelings about being a person of colour within the palliative care sphere. And we've had 9 of these sessions now, and the power of them is phenomenal. People are able to come together and say what experiences they've had and then try to work out ways that maybe we can tackle them, or whether it's even just a supportive space where you can reflect and hold each other.
And I think that is so important, having that space, that shared space where people understand. And I think, interestingly, it's one of the things that people say about the hospice from a patient perspective is that it's when you come together with other people that have a progressive lifelong limiting condition, you can talk about things that you can't talk about with family, for example. So having that for ethnically minoritized staff is really, really important. I think one of the other things I we're trying to do a bit of, and I'd love to see more of, is we do something called Volunteer to Career at the hospice, where people can come, they volunteer, they get some mentoring. And the idea is that helps them go into healthcare professions, and really making sure that is as ethnically diverse as possible, because then people will perhaps see palliative and end-of-life care as a career once they've qualified in whatever chosen clinical field that they want to go into. But even if they haven't, what we've then got is a group of clinicians who have an experience of it, and it'll stay with them. And I know from speaking to a range of different GPs and others, that they've been through the hospice at some point for their training and it stays with them forever. So that just generally raising that awareness amongst the communities, but also amongst healthcare professionals, I think is really important.
Absolutely. I can second that because over the years, the training staff who came through the hospice, again, a lot of them might have settled locally as GPs, but I think it's to do with the environment as well. Hospices, you know, when you work in a hospital, you almost, I don't really like the term family, but you really are a close-knit group of people who work together, and you're just as likely to be sitting and having a laugh with the somebody who works in the canteen as you are with a consultant or the clinical lead in the hospice, because it's such a different environment to being in a hierarchical hospital.
Yeah.
I think that when a person comes in and spends a few months, even a few weeks, they leave with something much more than just what palliative care is as a specialty. They leave with that whole feeling of what it stands for and what it means.
Definitely. Well, that's been brilliant. I think there's probably loads of things that we could talk about around this subject. And it'll be interesting, I think, to keep revisiting this as things progress and we learn more and more. But in the meantime, Karen, thank you so much for your time. It's been brilliant I've been trying to get this sorted for quite some time. So it's been brilliant to have you on the podcast. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chef Steph. That's wonderful.
I hope you've enjoyed that episode of Black All Year. It would be great if you could subscribe and review, because not only will it make sure that you get the content, but it'll help other people to find it too. Take care.